The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. Visit emsmanager.net for a free trial of this innovative and easy-to-use EMS employee scheduling and management software.
Everyone, this is the EMS Educast on behalf of Rob Terrio, Bill Toon, and from time to time, our friend David Blevins. This is Greg Fries. David, we've been missing you. We're looking forward to summer break being over and you joining us either for some minis or some full shows, whatever your pleasure is. But this is a little call to action for you to come on back. Summer's almost over, pal. It was 39 degrees Fahrenheit here this morning, guys, and I see little tinges of fall on a few of the leaves. There's bags of school supplies staging in our guest bedroom. So it's just around the corner.
Mm-hmm. It's getting cooler quickly.
And when does your child go back to school, Rob?
Believe September 3rd.
Okay.
We our semester start in September.
Yeah.
Our daughter, she's back in already. She had 2 half days and today was her first full day. Plus our exchange student who arrived last week, she is, started school.
Wow. And where is your exchange student from?
She is from Azerbaijan.
Wow, Gesundheit.
And, yes.
I would have to look on a map, but can you give us a...
Yes, it's the capital is right off the Caspian Sea called Baku.
Okay.
And it's just a little, it's north, they border with Iran and Turkey, Georgia. It's Eurasia is okay. Often it's referred to.
Wow. And for a full year?
The full school year, so she'll be here till next May.
Wow, outstanding. That's great of you to do that, Bill, and welcome somebody into your family for a year.
Yeah.
What's the exchange program?
It's called AFS.
Okay.
And this young lady happens to be what's called a flex student, so she's future leader exchange, and this is a program that a division of the State Department sponsor, so we actually all help sponsor her to come here. She had to go through a competitive process to even be selected to come here to the United States. So,
and her reward is Kansas.
That's right. She's just happy to be here. So they're all over the country, though. So
that's great. Well, that's cool. Were you ever an exchange student?
No, I'm sorry, because this young lady speaks wonderful English.
Yeah,
she speaks her native language of Azerbaijan. She speaks Russian and understands Turkish.
Wow.
So I feel very inadequate.
Yeah, well, get the Rosetta Stone. I've heard great things. Rob, how about
– we can do a whole episode on Rosetta Stone and the pedagogy of that method.
I've never listened, but I'm certainly interested. Rob, were you ever an exchange student or –
No.
Me neither. I went to the University of Idaho for a couple of years. That sometimes felt like an international experience.
in Idaho. If someone's eating in the background, make sure you mute your mic.
I'm sorry, that might be me.
Oh, really?
And I also crunched some ice and I muted my mic.
I was trying to recover some dinner from my teeth. Sorry about that.
That's TMI. Okay.
Yeah, well, nothing that floss won't fix. Guys, we actually have a guest, and he's probably second-guessing his participation in this. But Bob Sullivan, welcome to the EMS Educast.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Have you ever been to Azerbaijan or been an exchange student?
I've been to Canada.
Okay.
I did. I grew up right on the Canadian border, so I spent a lot of time between ages 19 and 21 in Canada because that's the drinking age.
Right.
And where along the border? I don't want you to incriminate yourself with the precise location if you don't want to. But
Buffalo. Yeah, Buffalo. No, I grew up in Buffalo, New York. That's where I started working in EMS.
Okay. Well, Buffalo is sort of a hotbed of EMS types that are looking for a bigger audience. Skip Kirkwood comes to mind as a native of Tonawanda, New York, in the Buffalo area. And Kyle Bates. Jeff Myers, Dr. Jeff Myers, who's written paramedic textbooks, is from Buffalo. I don't know if he's originally from Buffalo, but what is it about Buffalo, Bob, that leads it to be that way?
Unfortunately, a lot of people leave. I left, but you know, it really is the EMS systems where, you know, they're mostly private. They don't pay very well. And, you know, I sort of left seeking, you know, I wanted to make this a career and to make a living and not, you know, have to work 60 hours a week like many of my coworkers did.
Yeah.
So I know Dr. Myers went on to become a doctor. He worked for the service that the other private service, and I believe he's still their medical director.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I just was lucky enough to have dinner with him and Kyle and Ann Robinson while we were all at the NEMC symposium last week. And he mentioned some medical direction that he's doing, but I can't recall the service. And, of course, Kyle, longtime friend of the show, is paramedic there for a town of Tonawanda.
He actually works in the town where I grew up. That's like the one they're like the one municipal service that covers the town. And I used to, as a child, rode my bike and would listen to a police scanner and would chase on my bicycle, the trucks that, you know, some of his coworkers that he works with now. So, it's neat that he landed there.
Well, so it sounds like we got to dig in to your history, how you became interested in EMS, education background. And, as you know, as a longtime listener of the show, we don't want to leave any stone unturned, and Bill hopefully will probe for even more depth and detail. So tell us how you got to this point.
Well, my family will tell you, I was always born to be a paramedic. You know, I started watching emergency reruns, and then Rescue 911 came on, and my grandfather got me a police scanner, and I had one friend in the neighborhood. We would both listen, and when we'd hear a call in our neighborhood, we'd ride our bikes over there, and he kind of grew out of it. I never did. And so I didn't think I was smart enough to be a paramedic because I always really struggled in the science classes, like in high school. And so I always thought it was something I would maybe volunteer as an EMT and do on the side. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do after high school. So I joined a third of my classmates from the Catholic high school and went to the Catholic college in Buffalo. And there I took an EMT class in addition to my other classes at the community college. And I started working for a private company. And from the first day I was hooked, like, yeah, this is it. And I couldn't have nearly as much fun doing anything else. And like I said about sort of the sad state of, you know, I know Rural Metro Ambulances in Buffalo that's just declared bankruptcy. And I didn't work for Rural Metro. I worked for the other service that was there. And people just sort of bounced in between them. And there really wasn't much of a career. That it wasn't a lifestyle that I really wanted. So I moved after college and I went to paramedic school in the DC area at George Washington University. And the plan was I wanted to work for one of the fire departments, and I moved there because I had some friends that sort of moved to the area. That's a lot of Buffalonians sort of transplant to the D.C. area. And my uncle lived there, and so I kind of knew some people. I went to paramedic school there. And I did my ride-alongs with one of the fire departments, and I just kind of the thing that I would have been a firefighter, but you had to do exclusively firefighting for a year, so I would have been a paramedic. If I was hired, I would go through a fire academy and go through all my probationary firefighter stuff before I could do anything as a paramedic. And So I kind of ended up working for a private company after I graduated. And then while I was there, I met my wife, who was from Delaware, and did a ride-along at Newcastle County EMS and thought, oh, that looks kind of cool. And, you know, I kind of liked my wife when we started dating, so let's give this a try. And I've been a paramedic with Newcastle for 10 years and just short of 10 years, and I have 6 more shifts left before I start the education job.
Oh, wow. So then, and that brings us to the reason that we're going to have a conversation tonight. But did you get better at science, or did you realize that it wasn't as difficult as you thought it was going to be?
Well, for me, it was just the experience as an EMT. I got to work in the city of Buffalo, and as an EMT, I was partnered with a paramedic right off the bat. And we really just get thrown to the lions. But I worked with some great partners, and they taught me a lot. And I sort of got to see, they got to be in charge when we'd have a really sick, you know, like CHF patient. I kind of got to stand in the background, and I would set up their IVs, and I would put them on oxygen, and I would attach them to the heart monitor. And I sort of got the rhythm of, you know, the muscle memory of, you know, and spiking IV bags, things like that. So I was able to do that without thinking, well, I'm watching them, you know, manage this patient. And then afterwards, you know, a lot of them would explain to me what they were doing and why they were doing it. And so it's, for me, that experience, you know, I know that you've had some shows about the, you know, do you need to be an EMT first, or can you go right to paramedic? And for me, I had to be. If I was thrown right from high school into a paramedic program, like some people do in other areas where I've been, that I would not have worked. I would have failed. But having the experience as an EMT and already, you know, having a mental picture of the things that I'm being explained to in class, that's sort of what got me through it.
That's a neat insight to have of, since you've seen, say, things like heart failure, and then when you're in class having that discussion about pathophysiology, it was, you were able to visualize it, and that was helpful. Is that the way?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Bill, what else do you want to know about Bob's background?
How about some of your formal education that you have?
Okay, well, I went to Canisius College, and I ended up graduating with a bachelor's degree. And it was interesting. The my junior year was when I first started working as an EMT. And the following fall, which would have been my senior year, I could have gone to paramedic school. That was the last year it was going to be a year-long program. After that, it was going to be 2 years. And I was really struggling. I'm like, okay, should I just go to paramedic school now and get the patch in a year? Or should I, you know, because I'm always, you know, thinking I would go back and finish my bachelor's, or should I finish the bachelor's? And I finished the bachelor's, and I'm so thankful that I did. I think that if I had gone to paramedic school, then I probably, I'm not saying I wouldn't have gone back, but it would have probably taken a while. And so I ended up graduating with degree in communications and psychology, really figuring that I wanted to be a paramedic, and those were just classes that I thought were interesting. And I wrote for the paper while I was there, and, you know, did some other things. I was a crisis phone counselor as part of my internship for the psych major. And so it was interesting. The culture was, you know, why would you be a paramedic? Like, my coworkers were like, why would you be a paramedic if you have a bachelor's degree? Why don't you be a PA? And I wasn't interested in being a PA or a nurse, or, you know, I really enjoyed, you know, I wanted to be a paramedic, and I really enjoyed EMS. And, you know, why would you make $10 an hour with a bachelor's degree? And I really struggled with that. But it all ended up working out. You know, I have no regrets over any of the career choices I've made. And I'm really happy that I stayed and got the bachelor's degree and went on to paramedic school.
It's interesting because I think even the general lay public have a perception of medicine as a hierarchy, and often question, you know, if you have some post-secondary education, why wouldn't you go a step higher? And people just don't seem to understand the difference between out-of-hospital care and in-hospital care, and all of the things that are really great about doing paramedic work versus, say, working as a PA or as a nurse or a doc?
Yeah, and I'm really going to miss it. That's why it was a struggle. I'm very excited to be an educator, and the timing is right to make this move for a number of reasons. But yeah, the one-on-one patient care, I'm going to miss doing a lot. And it is unlike, you know, it's not like nurses. You're by yourself. You make this connection with someone in the back of an ambulance, and you can just watch, you know, oftentimes you can do something that will at least help them feel better, or at least just being there helps them, you know, become less anxious and more at ease, and there's a sense of relief, oh, help is here. And I don't think other healthcare professionals, they're sort of just in and out, and, you know, they have an important role, and they do, they're great caregivers. You have the opportunity to be a great caregiver as other health disciplines, but it's just different the way, you know, we interact with people.
Go ahead, Rob. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think there's something really unique about the environment in which we make that connection. You know, just to add to what you said, that it's the very timing of the crisis, the incident, is such that, you know, we're the first ones there and can have a real significant impact on how they feel, and, you know, either bringing calm or adding to the chaos in the situation. And there's a certain reward to that I just don't think you get in any other health discipline.
No, and even though I'm going to try to drill that into my students, you know, what an honor it is to be, you know, going into someone's bedroom in the middle of the night and they're having shortness of breath, and then that it's a privilege that I think too many of us take lightly, and it just sort of becomes a routine. But it really, when you stop to think about it, it really is an awesome responsibility that we have. You know, whatever your certification level is, just the fact that you're, you know, in this environment for patients.
And you think about someone who's been involved in a car crash, and they, you know, there's this overwhelming psychological shock of the incident, and they don't know where they are and what happened, or if they're injured, or if they are, how badly they're injured. And then you come along and you introduce yourself, and you bring a certain calm, and you bring a certain reassurance, and just that in and of itself, I find, is a hugely rewarding aspect of this, the field we're in.
Yeah. Oh, and to get back to Bill's before I forget, I'm one class in my thesis away from getting a master's degree in healthcare administration.
Wow, that's so excellent.
Thank you. Yes.
Congratulations.
I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it ending.
Okay, well, we better let you go so you can get back to work.
Right. Do you have a topic for your thesis?
I'm going to do I'm going to focus on the priority medical dispatch system. My original piece of research is the seizure card for the priority medical dispatch system.
Okay.
And because the system I work in now is a tiered system where they only send paramedics to calls believed to be life-threatening. And I don't understand the logic of some of the cards, because the seizure call, there are studies that show that the alpha, or the seizure call that should get a BLS-only response, requires a seizure medicine just as often as the, you know, the Charlie Delta seizure calls, which would get a paramedic response. And so I was able to dig in to see how often that happens and how many patients might not get the seizure medication. And I used the study by Brent Myers and the Eagles with the benchmark paper that showed, you know, how often, you know, the seizure patients get Versed. You know, one, I believe it's every five actively seizing patients that get Versed, one will have their seizure terminated and the subsequent brain damage and mortality risk that gets prevented.
And how, so, of all the seizure calls that happen in a given system, what percentage are recurring or status seizures?
I don't have the numbers in front of me. I do. I sort of got the data and was busy with something else, and I haven't really looked through it yet.
I would think it would be extraordinarily small. I mean, I would guess 99% of the patients we get called for are postictal, and that's a seizure that just sort of happens and isn't likely to happen again in the course of our care. Would you guys agree with that? Would that be your experience?
It's actually, I don't know the percentage of the seizure calls that would get a BLS-only response, but it's more than I would think. I did have there was actually a call that I had when there was such a BLS unit was responding to a seizure call, and there happened to be a bad car crash right, it was in a church, and there was a car crash right in front of the church. So all the resources got devoted to the car crash because there were more victims. And then finally, about 45 minutes into it, they went, and this poor person, I think they actually had a hemorrhagic stroke, had been seizing the entire time, the entire 45 minutes that everybody was at the car crash in front of the church. And you know, by the time we got there, it was, you know, much, much further into it than should have happened. So and I just sort of started probing and reading more about that. And
yeah, my anecdotal experience, Rob, was only that I have several times where, like, the sort of ongoing status epilepticus just went unrecognized, and that it was just sort of like, oh, this is just prolonged postictal, or this is their baseline. And that's just like my anecdotal. I'd be interested, Bill, in your sort of like broader look at your system. Do you have any thought on that?
Lots of thought, but no specific answer towards that. Okay. And that's all. I mean, it's just that, you know, the bottom thing is I think the true status seizure is rare. Would everyone agree?
Yes.
Yeah. And the most common cause for someone to have a seizure is failure to take their anti-seizure medication. And most of those people do fine just getting evaluated and getting their levels checked and rebalanced and stuff. So the challenge is, as though, is how do you separate that patient population out from the one who truly needs a higher level of care?
Yeah. I want to go back, Bob, to you mentioned you did this psychology major, and you also spent time in a crisis call center. And because paramedics also see a lot of patients with mental illness, like, that experience must have, how'd that help you for the work ahead or impact the care you were able to provide for patients that were having mental health illness, maybe in addition to other types of illness or injury?
Well, it was a great experience just learning how to talk to people and learning more about, like, the mental illnesses, certainly, than, you know, we're taught in EMT class. And most of the time I was partnered with a paramedic, but there were a few trucks. We had a few BLS trucks, and psych calls would be BLS. So we would go, and you know, my partner and I would be the one in charge, and there was a lot of opportunities just to sort of talk to people, to let them agree to let you take them to the hospital, and just like how to stand and, you know, make eye contact with them, and when it's appropriate, when it's not to. So that was a huge, and it still is a huge help in, you know, interacting with that population of patients. It was also like the blow to, it also like sort of sealed the deal that I wanted to be a paramedic, because the crisis center, I'd be on the phone with people, and it was really frustrating. And it was located across from the main, you know, posting location where our ambulances, my service, would park. So the whole time I'm sitting there on the phone, and then I'm watching the ambulances go by, and I'm thinking, yeah, that's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Well, I mean, that's neat that it just really spoke to you so well, and you knew what it was that you wanted to do, and now you're doing it. We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, we're going to dig into this career move you're making. So, short break.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. They have been consistently helping EMS agencies save time and energy with their innovative web-based software for staff scheduling and management. There's a mobile web app accessible from smartphones or other mobile devices with an easy-to-use web interface viewable from anywhere on the World Wide Web. You can check your own schedule, and managers and staff can oversee, manage, and make changes to employee schedules from anywhere. One Indiana EMS service manager called scheduling a part-time job all by itself, but with EMS Manager, he was able to schedule an entire month of coverage in just a few hours. That's a significant amount of time and money saving for services struggling to make ends meet. It's affordable, too. Pricing for EMS Manager is based on the size of your organization, and because it's web-based, Your employee schedule and software is located in the cloud, meaning there is no additional local IT cost to worry about. And there's always free training, free tech support, and free system software updates. If you want this for your system, check out the free customizable trial of EMS Manager at emsmanager.net. We would like to thank EMS Manager for sponsoring the EMS Educast and other shows from the ProMed Network. EMS Manager is proud to support EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship and the support of what we do. Show your support for them. Take a few minutes and sign up for the free trial at emsmanager.net. Show them that you appreciate their support by trying out the software. Visit emsmanager.net for LADtech's EMS Manager for online employee scheduling and workplace management. Let them know you heard it here on the EMS Educast. emsmanager.net.
So just a few days ago, our guest, Bob Sullivan, put up on his blog that he was taking a new job as a paramedic instructor at the community college. And, you know, we're interested on this show at all the different points that educators might be in their career. And, Bob, I just want to start out with the question of, like, how did you know it was time to start looking to move from full-time in the field to full-time in the classroom?
Well, it's a couple things. I had taught on the side for a while. I was an ACLS instructor. I taught CPR. I taught a few continuing education sessions for my service, and I was an adjunct at the college I'm going to be joining. One of the things that I did was when the paramedic students do their hospital clinicals, there actually is an instructor from the college assigned to precept them, which I would have loved when I was a paramedic student because I was kind of shy and didn't like to get dirty and sort of feel like I was butting in.
Right.
But being the preceptor, you have like someone to interact with the hospital staff. So I've had some experience doing that. I really enjoyed that. And a couple of things happened. I've been with the service for 10 years. I could not imagine, you know, being a better fit for me. It was really, it was a system where I was able to like really, I think, develop my skills better than any other type of service, certainly in the area that I have been a part of before. But the night shifts really started getting to me. And I think I'm more sensitive to, you know, sleep cycles than some of my coworkers and some other people in the area. It doesn't seem to bother them as much.
I hear you.
My job before this one was we did 24-hour shifts, and I hated those too. That was just like torture. But everyone I worked with seemed, you know, they loved them and, you know, would go straight to, you know, play golf or something when they get off in the morning. And I just felt like I was going to die.
Wait till they die 20 years younger than expected. and then we'll be so happy.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But I just, I tolerated it. But then as I've gotten older, it just takes longer and longer to recover. And I just, so that was one factor. And I, you know,
Were you straight nights or were you, switching?
No, we do a day-night rotation. We do 2 10-hour days and 2 14-hour nights, and then we get 4 days off.
Okay.
And that's the way all the paramedic systems in Delaware have a similar version of that schedule, and as well as several in nearby Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Maryland. So it's sort of like a standard for the area. And when my son was born, I have a 3-month-old son, and I took some time off from FMLA, and I just noticed how much better I felt not doing the night shifts, even with my newborn son getting up every 3 or 4 hours to eat. So the spot opened up at the college. It's a good time for, you know, with my wife's career where she's at, this is a better time now than, you know, maybe 6 months or a year from now. And the program's expanding, so they're hiring they have 2 instructor openings. And they don't open very often. And I was just ready to try something else, you know, besides being a paramedic. I really, as much as I enjoyed the work, you know, I've read a lot, you know, education and about critical decision making. And I want to sort of find a way to apply that, you know, on a sort of a larger level.
And maybe you said this already, but will you be teaching EMT and paramedic levels?
No, just paramedic. The college just, okay, sends paramedics to the EMT classes are with there are some private companies that do education for at the BLS level and the fire school.
Okay.
Cool. Here.
So how, what, when you went through this process here for this position, what differentiated you from the other candidates? What made you feel that you shined and are prepared for this kind of responsibility?
Well, I try to get write one article a year for EMS World, and my article, just after going back and forth with the editors, it finally got through and was published 2 weeks before the job opened. So my interviewers had read it. That was a help. I told them how I have a blog, and I have some, I've taught with the college before as an adjunct, so I knew the most of the people that were interviewing me. But certainly, I think the bachelor's degree helped. That was preferred. And the master's degree that I'm pursuing, I think, helped with that also. For the, I also listened to several episodes of the Educast to prepare, you know, sort of when I do the interview.
That was a clincher.
Yeah. So,
that's what did it.
Yep. That we need to know those episode numbers or the topics that you went looking for.
Well, the difficult student behaviors, I knew I was going to get a question about a difficult student. That was a big help.
Oh, that's the awesome.
Questions for the new educator. I have many of those that answered some of them. And also one of the early episodes about the PowerPoints, I had to do a presentation. And I think that was the one with Kyle David Bates. So I knew it was going to be a small audience. So I had a white light background, dark letters for the presentation I put on and put a picture on every slide. So I think that helped too.
Wow, that's fantastic. Who would have known that adding EMS Educast to your curriculum vitae would put you up to the top of the candidate pile? Wow.
So another question, what have you done to prepare yourself to be an educator? And I don't care whether it be an EMS educator, you could be a classroom educator. In an elementary school or junior college or something.
Well, I took, I'm a member of NAMSE. I have the Foundations of Education book. I've read that. I will be rereading it shortly. And I took the, I don't believe it was the NAMSE instructor class. It was a state class. I have a state instructor class that I took that was based on a lot of the same principles. And I also read a lot. Like, I'm fascinated by, I read the Atul Gawande books and the Malcolm Gladwell books. I'm just fascinated about how to prepare, you know, how your brain works in, you know, stressful situations and thinking of, like, how to prepare people for those situations. So that's something I think I'll definitely be rereading those books and trying to prepare students in clinical and lab situations.
So what will the college do for you to prepare you to be a classroom professor?
Well, there's an orientation. The program chair's says he's working on some things. He's promised not to just throw me to the wolves right away. But there are some, the college has some, once a year they do, I forget what it's called, but it's like an instructor development program. So I'll be going through that also.
And Bob, will you be teaching strictly theory, or will they have you in the lab and in the hospital clinical as well?
They don't know. Actually, the program, they're adding some students, and in the past, they had sort of one person in charge of each of those, and I will be doing some of everything, probably more of one thing than another, but I'm not really sure of where I'm going to fit in yet.
Yeah, one of the reasons I ask is because sometimes the lab instructors in some programs are part-time, not full-time, and make a lower wage, so they keep the full-time faculty in the theory component.
Yeah, I did. We did some of that. I taught some labs as an adjunct there.
And do you know how many contact hours, though? Is there a maximum number of contact hours they give you once you've been through your orientation and your probationary period?
I don't know.
Okay.
I hope we're not filling you with a bunch of worry and uncertainty.
Yeah.
Do you know how many drawers will be in your desk? And what day will they issue the paper clips? Yeah, you know, I feel like Delaware's, well, it's a place I haven't been, but it's a pretty small place, and we've had Bruce and the Pond on the show in the past. Are you going to be working with Bruce?
And we've never had him back because we only have qualified people. Oh, Bruce. Oh. I'm sorry, Bruce.
Yes, I will be.
Okay. Well, I just met him a few times, just think the world of him as a just sort of real focused and deliberate educator, and that, you know, the attention to making that clinical experience, like you said, where there's an actual like preceptor in the hospital with the students, I just think is huge.
Especially because as an educator, it keeps you more current because it really, you're on the front lines.
And that's what they said, you know, I am going to miss the field very much, but that'll still be at the hospital. I'll still see the same people I work with now going in and out. And that will help me stay, you know, keep my hands dirty and maybe try a hard IV if a student's having difficulty to sort of keep, you know, some of my skills that way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the challenge for you is to remember to be the coach and not the player. So when the IV is actually difficult, it's to have the patience to teach them how to get it without you having to demonstrate how to do it.
That is going to be hard for me.
But it's see one, do one, teach one, right? So they have to see it first. So.
Oh, I think Bill just offered up a little gem of brilliance that is worth like digging into. Bill, how do you get the patience to do that and avoid the sort of like, watch me do this so you can do it next time, and next time might never happen?
Well, and I think that, and again, it's certainly a bias that I have, is I often challenge many of the supervisory personnel here. I says, did you ever think, wouldn't it be better if you coach them through how to start it instead of doing it for them? Because they're the people that are going to be in that situations where they need to learn. And I'd probably have to say, being in the operating room like I do has taught me how I need to explain to them clearly and concisely what it is they need to do to be successful. And I have to do it by not doing it for them. Mm. And they learn then much better that way by them they need to be doing it. It's a psychomotor skill. They need to be doing it. And if you do that for them, there's no question. You pat yourself on the back. You say, hey, man, I'm good. But in reality, I think then that you've truly failed the wonderful learning opportunity that existed there.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that reminds me of the episode where he did with the fellow from Canada that talked about the like guided visual imagery. And you just said something, Bill. You were like, you have to coach them on what they need to do to be successful. And coming up with the sort of right set of phrases and tempo to your instructions, and always focusing on the, you know, painting a picture of success rather than pointing out barriers or difficulties that can put negative, hurdles and barriers. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And I have to tell you, it's the humbling experience actually came when I was on a call. You know, I was an extra person on a call and I was down by the legs, and the opportunity came to place an IO. And I placed it because I was down there. And then later the supervisor, the other operational supervisor, says, why did you do that? They asked me. And it just stopped me dead in my tracks, and I says, good point, because a newer employee, a less experienced employee, missed the opportunity to do this interosseous on this pediatric patient in a stressful situation when I was perfectly capable of moving and coaching them through the process, and it would have been much greater learning experience for them instead of a high five for me. So to that person, kudos to them, because that was probably my first experience that really brought me down that says, no, I need to be the one coaching people to be successful and not showing off.
Yeah. Rob, you wanted to say something a moment ago.
Oh, I agree 100%. The guide from the side is absolutely the best approach. I you know, as an educator, if I was in clinical, occasionally I'd want to be selfish, especially with a high volume skill like an IV. I would feel compelled to start the odd IV here and there so I don't get rusty. But the classic guide on the side faux pas that doesn't happen, I see all the time, and I'm sure you guys see it too, is when you see cashiers being trained. It's amazing. The person who's training is always at the cash register doing it and describing what they're doing. And I just want to say to them, why don't you let the trainee do it while you tell them what to do? It's just the classic education faux pas.
Yeah, and it's an experiential thing. It's going to take some time to develop that discipline in yourself to realize that that actual in the trench experience for them with someone who can truly mentor them at that point is really much stronger, because eventually you're not going to be there and they're going to have to make this decision. And wouldn't it be better if it was a guided experience for them and you help them through that? But again, that's a mature, that truly is a mature skill. And it certainly didn't happen for me right away.
What do you think about this? We unpacked this piece a little bit.
Yeah, that's really great advice. And I'll certainly remember that, you know, because there is, when someone starts poking around and the patient's arm and you're like, oh, you're right next to it. Here, let me just show you. Right. And yeah, right. Someday you're not going to be there. So that's, as new educators, I think that's, first of all, I think EMS people are control freaks, you know, to begin with. So the idea of just letting something go and letting someone else doing something and sitting there thinking that you could be doing it better is a real struggle for a lot of us, just the nature of the work and the sort of the people that are attracted to it.
But it's interesting that we feel that we can do it better.
Yes.
That also in and of itself is a very powerful statement in itself. But the question comes, I think, though, what Rob is doing and then what I do in the operating room myself, if, for example, someone calls out sick, I just still go to the operating room experience to do that. Mm-hmm. Just me. And not in front of any of my peers or anything like that, other than my anesthesia peers that I have there. But I don't do it in front of the other paramedics to show off or anything. And so I find a way to create my experience, no different than Rob creates, by actually going and being a paramedic on an ambulance and keeping his skills honed that way. And I think that that is a much better opportunity than it is to be trying to, you know, you really are depriving them of a learning opportunity. So that's, I would caution you, even in the lab setting, when you're in the lab, I would caution you, particularly after you're farther, you know, it's one thing to do it up front in the program, you know, and they're new and it's a first time skill and you're trying to show them the demonstrate the whole part, whole process. You want to show them it in completion, then break it down into parts, and then show the final thing. But after you've done that, you have to develop the discipline to step back and let them develop those kinesthetic skills and stuff that come along with the cognitive knowledge and guide them through the process. It's a challenge to get to that point. And again, no one should expect anyone to do that right off the bat, but that's what a vision for you to look forward to.
That's great. This is a great mental image that I'll take with me when I start.
You're going to be in the ER, and there's going to be a bunch of staff sort of crowded around this patient that you're going to be protecting your paramedic student to, and coaching them and protecting them from all these people that are saying, get this done, get this done, get this done. Mm-hmm. And you're going to hear Bill's voice in your head, and you're going to turn into a coach, and you're going to have a moment of magic, and you'll guide that student through the process, and then everybody will say, oh, we knew he'd get it, or she, or whatever. And you'll then have this big release of stress and that you were protecting the student to coach them. And it will be grand. I'm looking forward to hearing about it.
I will blog about it when it happens.
Yeah.
So here's a model that's never been researched, and I've always thought it should be on the concept of see it, do it, teach it, maybe not the teaching component, but we have on occasion placed in the field two students with one preceptor. And so some people have said that's not nearly as effective as a model where there's one preceptor, one student, and then the preceptor's partner. that if you put two students with a preceptor, that they're not getting the volume of experience and therefore they're not getting as effective an education. But what I've seen, and again, this I really think should be researched, is there's something to be said about being the student who's in the spotlight and then being the student who's out of the spotlight and then back into it and out of it. Because I think, you know, students have tremendous insecurities and there's a great deal of, you know, they perceive a great deal of pressure when the expert is looking over their shoulder and they're the student and they're alone in that sense. And there's the feedback we get from our students who have gone into that model is there's a tremendous sense of relief when you can be in the spotlight and be the lead paramedic. And then you can step back and watch the other student take the lead and you can see their mistakes and learn from their mistakes and go, oh yeah, they do that too. They screwed up. And you know, it I think has an impact on your psyche. And, I wonder if the same would be true in the clinical, setting as well, in the hospital setting. So that's my hypothesis, that it's more effective.
And I'm going to support that because I had a chance to see that in action when I rode along with Seattle Medic One, and their paramedic students do that. They ride as partners, and there's the two regular full-time paramedics, and then there's the two paramedic students, and the paramedic students ride in the back of the ambulance. So there was five of us on the ambulance all together, the two paramedics up front, the two students in the back. And I just watched him, and these two were going on to the call. They said, pedestrian struck. Okay. I want you to, when you get there, I'm going to take the lead. I'll take the radio. I want you to grab this piece of equipment. If you'd get me the direct people to get vital signs, I'm going to collect the initial history. And they were putting their plan together. And what a wonderful way to begin to learn how to work as a team.
Yeah.
And then the paramedics literally put their hands in the pockets. And just they hovered closely and listened, but didn't take their hands out of their pockets and watched them do it. And it was spectacular to see them at work.
Wow. I love that model even better, where you have two paramedics and two students. I think that's even better than the model I described with one paramedic and two students, because the students are working as a team. They're learning how to work as a team, just as you described. Yeah. And the two other staff can just be the guides on the side. I think that's fantastic. Someone needs to research that.
And they don't. And the thing is that so when they get to the hospital, one student is responsible for report writing. The other student goes out just like they would as a paramedic partner and restocks the ambulance, prepares it for the next call, then comes in to provide any additional information to the person. So it's just I think there's place for it, but you know, Bob, these are all just ideas. These are concepts to consider. I hope you blog your experience as a new educator at the ALS level. And the challenge is I would encourage you to look yourself in the mirror and be very frank in your discussions about what you did well and didn't do well.
I do a lot of mirror looking, and one of the articles I got for one of the first articles I ever wrote for EMS World was about being a new paramedic and sort of the struggles and the things that I just was not prepared for, and I really want to spare not only spare you know the new paramedic graduates from that. I want them to learn from my experience from struggling, but also the patients that you know were victims of you know my poor judgment that I learned from and applied to future ones. So, you know, I am going to make a lot of mistakes. I am really excited to learn a whole new set of skills, like with presenting and curriculum development and those sort of things. And I will, you know, when I screw up, it will be on the internet, I promise.
Bob, before we start to wrap up, do you have a question that you want to ask any one of us?
Yeah, if you could do it in the time we have left, you know, what made you guys choose the education route, and when did you know it was time to move beyond working on the street full time?
I'll start with that one since there's a long pause here.
Okay.
I had one teacher who I didn't realize at the time, but she really inspired me. She was the most organized, succinct, student-centered educator I have ever seen. And that was 29 years ago, almost 30 years ago. And it really didn't sink in with me I guess thoughts of the way she taught until a few years after I embarked on the career. And that was one of my reasons. The other was I was offered a trainee position in Whistler, British Columbia, and we had ski patrollers who came and into our classes, and that meant I got free ski lift tickets for Blackcomb. So, yeah.
There you go. So I had academic coursework in adult education and curriculum and program design, and then I got into EMS. I came to EMS as already a teacher. And because of that background, opportunities to teach as I was also acquiring field experience came quickly to me. And I never have actually worked full time in the field, mostly because I had other opportunities to not work full time in the field and feel I can be most effective to EMS as an educator. Rather than field provider. So, it's because of my background and experience, it's been natural for me to stay where I'm at.
Do you know, for me, is that I believed that I was always a good patient care provider, that I cared about the people I was taking care of. And then I realized that it only could happen one patient at a time. And I thought, is there a way that I can impact and touch more patients? And if I became a good educator, I could influence the care of more patients in a positive way. So I could have a multiplying effect. And that's, you know, that may be a little arrogant to think that way, but I began to think that if I can find ways to impart, to be a compassionate care provider to other individuals, that they will go out and be a compassionate care provider, and I would be even touching more patients than I was as an individual provider. And that's what always makes me humble, is to think that if I can do my job well, many more people will benefit than just from me.
I think that's
when I was a provider.
I think that's a noble perspective.
Oh, yeah.
I really do.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
A lot more pressure than, yes.
And Bob, you're not new to this. You've been an educator. But I would say one of the things I love about teaching is it's in a lot of ways like a paramedic. You learn something new every day. You're right. always evolving as an educator. And, you know, I've been teaching full time for a long time, and I'm still aspiring to be a good educator or a better educator. So it's always something new. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. So true in that. And I would encourage you to watch other educators yes. educate and embrace those things that make sense and are create a positive learning environment for the student, and realize when you see something that is less than desirable, just say, I won't do that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's we can give a whole list of those in another episode.
Yeah.
All their pet peeves.
Yeah. Well, and be who you are. Like, there's a lot of noteworthy EMS educators out there, but, you know, trying to be like one of them, it isn't as good as just being true to who you are. And so go forth and welcome to the team, and we wish you great success.
Oh, thanks. This has been really great. I appreciate you having me on.
Let's wrap up, guys, with the recommendations. What's come across your desk or your iPod or library book or something that you want to share with our audience?
Sure, I'll start with this one. So I found a free ebook, and it's available on Apple products. I'm not sure if it's available on Amazon for PC as well, but it's called Clinical Teaching Guidebook, and it's free. It's by Deirdre Bonacastle from the University of Saskatchewan, and it's written for preceptors of clinical clerks and residents, so doctors in a teaching hospital setting. But I've been reading through it, and it's a great book, and it talks about various teaching theories and how to nurture students in the clinical environment. So free and available for iPad. Just not sure if it's available for Amazon, but we'll put a link in our show notes.
Excellent. I will go next. I want to sort of draw your attention to three things and then let you can connect on your own. But the July-September issue of Pre-Hospital Emergency Care has an excellent piece by some of our colleagues called Longitudinal and Regional Trends in Paramedic Student Exposure to Advanced Airway Placement. And the thing that's stood out to me was just the great variation in the number of median airway placements across geographic regions, from, you know, highs of 11, these are medians, to lows of 0. So the great variation. And then Kelly Grayson has an excellent piece on EMS1.com called The Bigotry of Low Expectations. And he really unpacks on this issue of airway management experiences for students and some paramedic education programs that are chafing on this idea of how to get 50 attempts at airway management for their students. And then he uses this term about pockets of excellence. And if you are desirous to have a pocket of excellence in airway management, I would remind you to go back to episode 171, where Bill Toon, our own Bill Toon, talked about how they've developed a pocket of excellence around airway management. And indeed, there is hard work involved, but great reward comes with the hard work. So there's a recipe if you want to have your program achieve excellence and have a high number of airway placement and airway management experiences for your students. And I'll put links to the show notes on those. Bob, do you have something?
I do. I know Tom Dick, I don't know if he's been on the Educast, but his book, People Care, the first edition was just such a huge influence on my career and my practice. And the second edition is much better. If you own the first one, it's worth buying the second. And just how to be a great caregiver, and you know, we focus so much on the skills and sort of the being resuscitation mechanics, that he just fills in so many gaps and how to treat people. And I will certainly reference it and share it with the students as I become an educator. And that's I'd recommend anyone at any point in their career to read that book.
I second that. I'm working my way through the second edition right now. Probably after we hang up, I'll go read a chapter. Bill, you get to wrap us up tonight.
Sure. Well, I want to give also my support of People Care. Tom Dick is just a wonderful man, a compassionate individual. I've known him for many years. And just an idea for you that are paramedic educators, one of the things that I always gave away as a graduation present is different authors at the time that talked more on what some people would call the soft skills. Tom Dick's book is often a soft skill. Kate Dunneker had one in her time, and I used to give those away as graduation gifts, and I would always get the authors to personalize them to each of my students as a gift, and because I wanted them to walk away with something that talked more about not just the technical skill of what they were doing, but the most important thing about what they were doing is how they were going out and touching people. Uh-huh. And how much more important that was. So I definitely think his is an excellent book to do. I'm going to go back to one of our previous episodes and that we had, and I want to reemphasize, it's called Evidence-Based Medicine, How to Practice and Teach in the Fourth Edition. And we had a guest of ours in the past that had recommended this based upon their lecture, their experience with evidence-based medicine. And I used this recently at the Kansas EMS Association conference to build my lecture around. And it, of course, in preparation, it caused me to dive into the book a whole lot more. And I just think it's a wonderful book, great for any educator to have and to improve how they approach teaching their students in the classroom to make sure that they have the latest and best information to work with.
Fantastic. Bob, thanks for being part of the EMS Educast. We really appreciate it. And we're going to have you on maybe around the first of the year for an update.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
Definitely. Well, on behalf of Rob and Bill and Bob and David, thanks for listening to the EMS Educast. And make sure you share episodes with your friends and colleagues. visit us at facebook.com/EMSEDUCAST. Look for me at EMS World Expo. And Bob, you're going, or you're not going? You're starting a new job.
No, I'm not. I wish.
and other events around. I just got a nice invitation to go speak at a state educators conference that I hope will come through. So I always enjoy those sort of opportunities. I know Rob does as well. So everyone have a great time when class starts up this fall.